I don't know, it's not even an answer.
No, but the characters are so... there's all of this, like, really fucked up shit that has happened. And then... And for much of the book, the mother figure is... because she's quite unwell, is silent. And then there's this, like, point in the novel where she, like, reclaims her voice. And it's this very, like, powerful kind of scene where... of clarity. And kind of reclaiming her voice. And it is very... honest, the way that she's talking to her daughter, it's this incredible, like, sense of honesty in that, that after having been silent for so long. Yeah, and it is a love story, like a reclamation between the both of them. Yeah, and also other people in the relationship around them, but yeah.
Jennifer?
I think, sorry, it's just really digesting that. No, I think, the story, I guess, that you're talking about is a story that's largely written from, or it is written from the perspective of...
I'm thinking about dogs in particular,
So it's told from the perspective of a young bloke living in Swan Hill, which is like a regional town in Victoria, and he is part of a group of mates, effectively. They're not a gang, they're just mates from school, and they... a sort of hobby for them is to go around picking up young girls to have sex with, and
like group sex.
And I was kind of interested in like, obviously it's a pretty horrific thing to kind of sit with as a writer and undoubtedly as a reader as well, but I was kind of interested in that gap that happens or that sometimes exists where without sort of I don't know, cutting perpetrators any slack, because a horrific act is a horrific act, period. I was kind of interested in those gaps of understanding that that sometimes happen and that might happen with young men who don't quite understand that they're not entitled to certain things, or who are still coming to I just wanted to try and kind of get into that headspace to know what it must be like to feel like you're owed that from another person, and what kind of gives you that sense of power and of hubris at such a young age.
I guess it's that like pack mentality thing going on too,
totally.
Where under the influence of drugs and alcohol, and you're in this like pack kind of group behavior mixed with like pretty intense privilege.
Well, they're footy boys, and like, you know.
You know what's fascinating about that, though? I was talking to this writing mate the other day about this, and in terms of your content that you've just talked about in mine, you have mixed reviews, right? When you do, when you enter into this, some people consider it brave or dangerous or whatever else, and I don't know that it's a choice. I just think for me it's not. But
why do people think it's dangerous?
Well, it is dangerous what you open yourself up to in terms of criticism, because people associate it is potentially really dangerous, because people, especially if you're writing realist works, sometimes will think that your ethics or your views or philosophies about life are, they align them with your characters. People do, especially with realist fiction. And so this person I was talking to the other day was saying that they'd had a conversation with someone else, not about my work, but nevertheless that in writing this material, that this other person was arguing that we perpetuate or we you know. And I think that's fascinating. I think it's bullshit, but I'm not okaying this, you know what I mean? But I think it's really interesting.
My question would be, why is it okay for... Like, I was just talking to a girlfriend about this the other, like, literally 12 hours ago.
Yeah.
Why is it okay? Like, we've sat... is Brooke here? No. This is her words wholesale. I'm plagiarising. But she was just like, we've watched your... We were talking about how a lot of people we know have found The Handmaid's Tale really difficult to watch. And her argument was like, we've watched your media and we've seen rape used as a plot point for decades now. The only reason you have a problem with it is because it's it's a woman telling the story about, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that plays into it as well. Which is not to say, obviously, that I think no men can write, you know, scenes involving sexual assault, for instance, convincingly or that they shouldn't. I just feel like that's kind of a bit of a... I have a problem with that argument being made that, like, we just shouldn't touch it as a topic.
I do too.
It shouldn't be exploitative, and it, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's question of whether it's gratuitous or not. And I think, like, within both of your novels, if you're actually reading with the text and engaging with the tone and the voice and how the characters are treated before and after the kind of acts of violence, you really do get a sense of it being. It's not a gratuitous kind of act. It's not for fun, you know.
People always have mixed reviews about these things, so I just wrote about this in relation to from an editing perspective, but also thinking about writing work and Gordon Lish's editing of Carver's work. And Carver, for any Carver fans, Carver writes into this gritty territory as a male author, obviously. Mm-hmm. And Lish edited his work to the extent that he cut some of those things away, you know. I think it's a matter of opening up questions, and I think that Carver did that, and Lish's editing limited, as disturbing as the conversations might be, the questions that Carver's asking, Lish in his editorial work closed down those conversations. So I agree with you, and we're entitled to, all of us, to ask questions through literature. It doesn't mean that you are. I think if you're successful, then the questions should be passed over to the reader as an anxiety and a worry rather than a statement about how we.
It's not condoning rape, for instance.
Yeah. Well, I just think I just think it's totally possible to write sexualized violence very poorly. Don't get me wrong,
for sure.
And I don't think we should all be, you know. But I just think that's a funny argument to make, because then it's like, well, are you going to not watch Game of Thrones? Are you going to stop watching Law & Order SVU, even though it's got a strong female protagonist detective? Like, I mean, come on.
Where does it end?
Yeah. Like, I feel like literature has possibly greater power to... I feel like literature can offer often something more nuanced than, you know, a lot of media out there.
I guess unfortunately, rape still happens all of the time, and then what are we only supposed to hear about rape through kind of the experience of the law court or the experience of the police file? I think there's also something quite like powerful in reclaiming that story and like giving it a kind of different context and experimenting with that and like bringing different perspective. And otherwise, there's a risk of looking at it only from a kind of clinical perspective. Or
the legal judicial framework is inherently problematic unto itself, and we know that, you know.
Yeah.
And so yeah, then
yeah.
Get into the
I don't know. Maybe it's a good part here to actually read some of. The text, I mean, I don't want... we don't have to read some of those, like, particularly violent spaces, but maybe thinking back again to the male voice in both of your books and those moments of the male gaze looking at the women or that acts of violence. Do you have anything?
Yeah, but I'll read from a new story to do that, I think, maybe.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to read... I'm going to read from this short story called Light Play, which is the one about the mother postpartum psychosis, and it's written in close third person from the son's perspective. I'm just going to read a little bit from the beginning and the end of that story. And when I wrote that story, when I heard about that that condition that I was wounded by, I tried really hard to write that story in the mother's. I felt like I wanted to write it from her voice, and I couldn't get her voice because obviously, she was in a state of psychosis. I just couldn't write it that way. And then, so I've written it from the son. But interestingly, in the last 3 weeks, I've gone back and written back to that story. So like this. So the person who told me that one day my work will no longer be fractured and in multiple voices is clearly not right. But anyway, so I'm going to read a really short bit from the beginning, which is the birth scene, and then a really short bit from the end, which is actually a sex scene, and it's the son. It's in the son's voice again, and that's how I could. Only way I could make that story work was through themes of urgency. Anyway, blah. Okay, so, Claire smells blood and bone, senses death, rotting flesh death, her own or baby Isla's, she isn't quite sure. She slaps at Aaron like poisonous air, staring with grey glass eyes, frozen in elsewhere time. It's worse than when she grabbed his neck, held on. By the time she's admitted, the scabs on his neck are dark and rigid like old memories. He drags the scabs under his fingernails as they restrain her. Claire's eyes skip over Aaron as if he's someone else's child. That's what she kept saying during the labour. It's someone else's, moaning through clenched teeth, baby. He was there when baby Isla was born. He says, it's yours, Mum, of course it's yours. He can't see past the moment, pelting pain and no fucking ambulance. He doesn't realise then what she means, but he understands pushing. He understands urgency. Hallucinations are immune to pushing and urgency. He calls the ambulance again and again. He barely has time to help his mum get her undies off. One leg is still hooked as she pushes on all fours like a horse. Big, powerful buttocks, milky white. By that time, he doesn't dare get close, thinking she'll kick him from behind. She's writhing and dangerous, groaning as if she were heaving furniture, sweaty and determined, heaving hopelessly until Isla comes out, wet and wrinkly, sceptical and disbelieving, an old person's expression on her baby face. It's so fast in the end, baby Isla on her chest, any rules about what a mother might say or do in the presence of her son, bygone. So that's like the mother and the son's last shared moment in kind of real time when her mind is okay, and then the middle part of the story is about her sinking, and then this is sort of the final bit from the final scene. Yep, it's about the same length. In the back, and this is in this scene, this nurse that the Aaron, the son, come to know really well, is driving him home from the hospital. In the back seat of the car with the beautiful nurse in the urgency, Aaron is making noises like the laptop. Yeah, baby, but without the words. He stops for a second, thinking it might be weird, but she's doing it too, although hers is more like baby, yeah, higher pitched but softer than him, like whimpering, because she's a girl. Her perfume is summery like flowers in Aerogard, like a herb potion with summer flowers, not like insect repellent, and her neck is salty and soft. He keeps thinking she's not mean, make it nice for her, but it's so urgent, we're taking her inmate. It's over so fast that he doesn't know if she came. It's so fast that one of her legs still has her stocking and undies attached, like his mum pushing Isla out. He touches the stockinged leg and he says sorry, and then he says thank you, and they laugh. He thinks she came because in the urgency she was stiff and hot, arching, pushing her hips up into him. The arching wasn't resistant, like getting his mum in the car. It was non-resistant arching, greedy and sweaty, and she didn't even flinch at the scabs on his neck. Raked to bleeding, again and again, pleasure pain fingers. He is eating her breath in the urgent arching because he can't kiss properly and they are gulping greedily at each other's breath. He thinks she came in the breath-eating urgency because now her breathing is exhausted and calm and deep, like his mum after Isla was born, before the strangeness set in. He thinks she came, but maybe she's just disappointed because he didn't satisfy her. Maybe the smell of death is looming. He can't smell it, but that doesn't mean it's not real. Maybe he misunderstood the arching and the urgency like people misunderstand clay, and maybe he was too caught up in the moment to give her generous sex. He felt that it was all about her, but maybe it was only ever about him. Memory is slippery and easily misunderstood, you see, like conditioner, like clay. It doesn't make probably much sense in the broader narrative, but in terms of the question you asked, I think it's interesting because it's the son's gaze and the son's understanding of those things.
And it's often a really different subjectivity for, like, a scene like that to be coming from that perspective.
Mm.
Yeah. I thought a lot about the narrative voice of the earth does not get fat, because it's pretty much all first person, but a kind of a direct spoken first person. So it's not an internal monologue. Pretty much, I don't think there's any internal monologue at all. It's all kind of information that is passed between characters, like from a particular, like, so I have done this, or I'm doing that, or this is what I think, and I'm narrating this story, or there's a letter that is sent from one character to another, which kind of direct first person account. So it kind of shifts. It's interesting because the birth scene in this novel is like very different because of that different kind of narrative voice. And in The Earth Does Not Get Fat, it's like very urgent.
Hmm.
So I was wondering if you were thinking about that when you were thinking about that voice.
Yeah, you're right, it's totally different. I mean, it's totally different. The birth scene in the book is first person from the mother's perspective, and she's alone, so it's much it's much more desperate, kind of.
Yeah.
And it's written from her inside her body. But maybe
it's such an embodied voice.
Mm-hmm.
It's like very much coming in from the inside,
I mean, I can talk more about it, but you should.
Yeah.
I was enjoying listening too.
Please talk more about it. I was
I mean, in comparison, though, just thinking about, like, narrative voice, Pulse Points is often very interior and bounces between speaking to past and in the past and in the present. And there are many voices, many genders, many classes, many geographies, but they do feel quite connected through this, like, interior voice. And maybe because I read one after the other, there was such striking difference between where that voice was coming from. But yeah, I wonder, when you're writing a collection of stories like this that are coming from so many different perspectives and so many different voices, is there a kind of tone that you're trying to create, like, a through chord with those, or with the kind of language that you're using? Or did you re-edit some of the texts, or...
I think it's funny when people read this and they're like, they're connected by a theme or a thread.
It's because we're searching for it.
No, I know. Yeah. It's great. Like, it's like somebody else has done the work for me. But I think they fit together because they... I don't know. They're written with the same attention to detail, for instance. Like, there are certain things that I will always do as a practitioner because it's just how it rhymes.
Yeah.
But
I guess I meant, though, is that even though there's kind of a diverse geography, you know, there's like a story in New Mexico and regional Australia and different times and places and different genders, different kinds of relationships with people, but there is something about the language that ties them together. And I think it's the rhythm of the interior narration or something. For me, that's what it was.
I'm really interested in the kind of minutia of everyday life. And so a lot of that is interiority. And probably a lot of being a writer and a reader as well as interiority. And so I think it that makes sense to me that all of these people have these, rich or fleshed out interior lives. And also, like, I'm just fascinated generally as both a reader and a writer in those gaps of understanding or things that we don't say or moving in and out of time. All of that stuff that is kind of necessarily happening in your own head. Mm-hmm. And you can externalise it. You can point out the subtext, you know, very directly of what someone else has said, but we don't tend to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's like a fascinating thing to experiment with and to consider.
Maybe we could hear.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
I don't think I'm going to read from that sad story, Dogs. I'm sorry. I try not. I feel like it's... I don't think it's a good one to read. Because it's a huge bummer. No.
It's a wonderful story.
Thank you.
Yeah.
No, I feel like in this particular moment, like, almost every woman I know has had some sort of experience of assault. And I just want to be, I don't know
we don't
anybody
needlessly,
in this room.
We don't needlessly need to trigger each other right now.
Yeah, that's...
Yeah.
But I am going to read... I might read from the start of a story called We Got Used to Hear Fast, which is about two children who go to live with their grandparents up in Toowoomba. They sort of take a bit of a road trip from Frankston in Victoria up north